Michigan is now a so-called right-to-work state, signing into law a bill that prevents unions from requiring employees to pay dues. Will the effects ripple into Iowa? This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. The new Michigan law is being called a political defeat for unions. And this hour, even though Iowa has been a right-to-work state for some time, we examine the state of Iowa's unions. We'll talk with leaders of three of the state's unions, a labor historian, and a state lawmaker. What's your perception of unions? Do you think their power is declining? The state of Iowa's unions, after this news. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. No one can argue that organized labor wasn't served a setback by Michigan's new law last week. It bars unions from requiring workers to pay dues, even in unionized workplaces. The passage of right-to-work legislation, as it is called in the state, a state dominated by the auto industry and the historically powerful United Auto Workers, was a surprising smack in the face to unions. What are the ripple effects in Iowa? What is the state of Iowa's unions anyway? That's our focus today on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a moment, we'll be joined by leaders of the state's unions. But first, we wanted to make sure we have a firm historical footing to talk about unions in Iowa, organized labor. And here to help us do that, Shelton Stromquist, a University of Iowa professor of history, who works primarily in the fields of U.S. labor and social history, also the author of the book Solidarity and Survival, an oral history of the Iowa labor movement in the Iowa labor in the 20th century. Professor Stromquist, Shelton, welcome to our program.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Let's start off by having you tell us, trace the formation and history of unions in Iowa, if you could briefly.
Well, I think one of the things that has to be said at the outset is that despite its reputation as an agricultural state, and deservedly so, we obviously are a state that produces a great deal of the country's food supply, Iowa has always been an important site for wage workers outside of agriculture. And in some ways, I think Iowa's story is not altogether different, or certainly not fundamentally different from the story of labor in the rest of the country. There are some interesting and distinctive features, however. Because of the nature of its economy, there was always a significant portion of manufacturing and food processing that was devoted to augmenting the agricultural economy. So farm equipment production was logically an important industry here, as was meatpacking going back to the 19th century. But so were railroads. We were traversed by many rail lines beginning in the late 19th century, and railroad workers in Iowa were very, very important to the state, to building the early state labor movement. Another aspect of Iowa's early economy and union movement that we sometimes neglect because it's not visible today is coal mining. Iowa was at one time one of the major coal-producing states in the country, and coal workers, coal miners, were a very important part of the story of building an Iowa labor movement, not only in the coal mining villages of south-central Iowa and the Fort Dodge area, but also the children of coal miners who migrated to cities and towns to build farm equipment or to process meat in big packing plants.
So if we go back to the dawn of organized labor in this country and in Iowa, what forces are at work, I'm assuming in the early 20th century, that give rise to organized labor?
Well, I think, you know, in the period of industrialization that extended over more than a century, workers, you know, worked under very adverse conditions with very little voice in the determination of their wages, their hours, their working conditions. And you know, there were lots of grievances, lots of reasons to be concerned if you didn't have a voice over those conditions. Mine safety was a terribly important issue to coal miners, as it was to factory workers. But so were the low wages that were typically being paid, especially to the unskilled or semi-skilled workers in the mass production industries. But fundamentally, I think what gives rise to organized labor is the desire for respect and dignity. Unions bring that to the equation. It gives workers a voice, a sense that they matter, that their work matters, and that they are valued. And when they're not treated with respect and dignity, there's nothing more inflammatory, shall we say, in terms of driving workers to organize collectively.
We want to listen to some audio in the interview, a couple clips of the interview collected by the State Historical Society of Iowa and provided to us. We are grateful for this because it really does provide us firsthand account of what it was like. We're going to be hearing a couple of clips of Don Harris, an early Iowa union organizer. And Shelton, you can probably tell us more about him. I have that he is we're going to be hearing him describe work at what is the Rawlins Hosiery Mills, a Des Moines hosiery mill, which would become the country's first major manufacturer of nylon stockings. What else do we need to know about him before we listen to a little bit of?
Well, Don Harris's story is very much an Iowa story. His father, I think, was born in Perry, and he grew up. Part of his youth was spent in Iowa, and then they moved to a farm in the Dakotas. And like many farmers in the 1920s, Don Harris's family simply couldn't make it because the prices were driven down so low. And so there were a lot of young people like Don who migrated off of farms into towns and cities looking for work. And so Don arrives in Des Moines as a young worker at a very critical moment. It's just early in the Depression, and conditions couldn't be worse for workers at Rawlins and other working places.
Okay, so let's listen to this first clip. Don Harris describing conditions in 1930. And he is at this time working at the Rawlins Hosiery Mills.
1930, when I started working there.
We've got the Depression.
It was during the Depression, and things were terrible. We was only making starvation wages, working 72 hours a week, six 12-hour nights, no vacations with pay, no fringe benefits whatsoever.
I was just going to ask you what it was that gave you religion in terms of the unions and why you became a union man. I think you've started to answer my question there, didn't you? With the conditions.
Well, that's right. We had, of course, you could be fired at the whim of the boss. We had no benefits, no protection. They come around and say, due to the present economic situations, we find it necessary to cut your wages 10%. Well, that was it. Your wages were cut 10%. You didn't have any recourse. Mm-hmm. And so when Roosevelt was elected and the NRA was promulgated with its famous Section 7A, the right of the workers to organize and bargain collectively, well, hell, we took it. We jumped at it. So did other workers around other plants. They weren't as successful as we were.
So some words of Don Harris, an early Iowa union organizer, describing 1930, the dawn of the labor movement here. What did you hear specifically in that clip, Shelton Stromquist, that jumped out at you that you want us to take notice of?
Well, I think what Don is describing is the condition that was very typical for workers in all kinds of workplaces in the early Depression, simply employed entirely at the whim of the employer, having no voice or predictability about what the future held in terms of your wages, your ability to support your family, no fringe benefits, none of the things that we associate these days with what it means to to do a good day's work. Mm-hmm. And so this arbitrariness, this inability to have any control over your livelihood in the harsh conditions of the Depression, and then with the, you know, with the affirmation by President Roosevelt in the National Recovery Act, Section 7A that he referred to, that workers actually should have a right to organize, and employers should be required to sit down with their employees and bargain over reasonable conditions. And this was like a you know, this is like a clarion call, if you will, to wage workers all around the country. And Don's generation, that group of young workers in the early 1930s, simply took that message and carried it far and wide.
And here's another clip of Don Harris talking about the early Iowa unions being organized that will provide us insight into how different a setting it is than we have today. A shorter clip here talking about how, when they wanted to introduce organized labor, a union into a factory, they had to be very secretive. Here is Don Harris in audio provided to us by the State Historical Society of Iowa talking about that aspect.
Convince them.
We had to take the message to people in the plant, and it had to be done on an absolute secretive basis. We literally met in basements. Because there was the company was seeking some stool pitching, you know. They would send people to the meetings in order to find out who was there so they could fire them the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It was in the 30s. That's what happened.
Well,
we organized underground.
Do you remember?
No doubt about it.
Don Harris there. Interesting. Really an eye back to previous generations, even before the boomer generation. Boomers growing up may not remember this, would they?
Right, right. No, I mean, this notion that you had no rights and that you were employed entirely at the whim of your employer and could be fired for anything, certainly for trying to organize a union.
What would you identify as the major milestones in the labor movement in Iowa?
Well, I think that the milestones in Iowa correspond very closely to the milestones in the rest of the labor movement in the country. I mean, clearly what Don Harris is describing in terms of the passage of the National Recovery Act and Section 7A that gave enabling voice to workers to begin to organize, even though it didn't actually materialize in a lot of union organization in many plants until the Wagner Act in 1935, which was really labor's Magna Carta. This was the act that that created the National Labor Relations Board, that set up, you know, legal procedures by which workers had a right to organize, to form unions, and ultimately to bargain collectively with their employers. I'm sure we'll get to this later in the hour. But the after the war, and the war, of course, World War II, I'm talking about, provided a tremendous stimulus to organized labor. Labor came out of the war in Iowa and around the rest of the country with a new kind of strength. They had been performing national service, and it was important to the country and to the government and to many employers that labor work hard and that in turn it be respected. But in 1947, Republican-controlled Congress, over the veto of Harry Truman, passed the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Taft-Hartley Act really set in motion a kind of wave of anti-union, anti-labor sentiment and public policy that the labor movement has been struggling with ever since. And indeed, it was the Taft-Hartley Act that created the enabling provision for states to pass right-to-work laws. And many states, including Iowa, followed very quickly in the aftermath of Taft-Hartley to pass such right-to-work laws.
Talking with Shelton Stromquist, a University of Iowa professor of history who focuses on the fields of U.S. labor and social history. We're talking about organized labor, the state of unions in Iowa, in light of the vote in Michigan, their new law last week, a setback for unions, barring unions from requiring workers to pay dues, even in unionized workplaces. Shelton, now this is when we say right to work, Is that all that that encompasses, that you may not require workers to pay union dues, the union may not, even if they're in a unionized workplace?
That's fundamentally
that's
it.
That's the gist of
right,
it.
Right, right. Okay. Of course, that I mean, that was a change in 1947 from what had been the norm really for not that many years, since 1935. But it did create this this window, if you will, for workers who were covered by collective bargaining agreements to opt out of actually paying their fair share of dues.
Do you remember what year that happened here in
1947.
Iowa? 1947. Yeah. As early as that.
Yeah.
Well, great that we have this historical foundation, because we want to invite others to join our conversation, leaders of three of the state's unions. Here we have in our Iowa City studio, Tammy Worrell. She is the ISEA president, the president of the Iowa State Education Association. Welcome to you, Tammy.
Thanks for having me here.
You've been sitting next to Shelton listening to that quick history of Iowa unions. In our Des Moines studio, Danny Homan is with us, president of AFSCME, Council 61, the American Federation of State, Council, and Municipal Employees. Danny, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And in our Des Moines studio as well, Ken Sager, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor. And welcome to you, Ken.
Thank you, Ben. Appreciate the opportunity.
And for the record, we want to mention that we invited House Republicans, Senate Republican leaders, the governor's office, and the Iowa Association of Business and Industry to be on this program. They all declined our invitation. So we want to go forward here and bring us more into contemporary times, specifically the latest news having to do with organized labor in this country. I'd like to get a reaction to each of you from what has happened in Michigan with the right to work law there. And earlier last year, we witnessed a change in Wisconsin. Would you start us off, Danny Homan?
Sure. Let me talk about Wisconsin first. In Wisconsin, a Republican governor and a Republican legislature stripped employees in the public sector, and only in the public sector, of their right to sit down and collectively bargain with their employer. It was interesting when I was listening to the history discussion about why unions organized, and the words respect and dignity were brought up. That's what this issue is about. An employer having enough respect for the folks that work for him and produce or provide the service to folks to sit down at a table as an equal and discuss wages, benefits, and terms and conditions of employment. And in Wisconsin, that won't be happening anymore because that state under Republican leadership decided to strip that away from most of the public employees in that state. And you talk about Michigan and putting in right to work. If that was such a good deal, and if that is such a wonderful thing, why did they do it in the manner in which they did it? Closed meetings where they wouldn't let people in, locking the state house, doing it under the cover of darkness, much like what they did in Wisconsin until 16 brave senators, or 14, don't remember the number right now, decided to leave the state to stop it. You know, if that was such a good thing in Michigan, why did they do it in the way it was? Why didn't they let people have input? Why did 20,000 people show up at the state capitol to demonstrate about that?
But yet, if people were so upset about this, and we knew that they were, of course, it was national news, they had the chance to vote Governor Scott Walker and others out of office through a recall. That didn't succeed.
Well, that's not true. In Wisconsin, they flipped the Senate for a period of time. Michigan, they repealed the emergency manager bill. And what I'm being told is they're preparing to pass the same bill in their lame duck session that was overturned by the voters of the state of Michigan and make it again the law of Michigan. And in the recall, you know, all that election showed me is if you're outspent 10 to 12 to 1, you may not win, because that's how much Walker outspent his opponent by in that recall election.
Danny Holman is president of AFSCME, Council 61. I wanted to make sure, I was jumping in here to make sure that Ken Sager gets a comment before we take a break. Ken, your comments on the latest developments in organized labor in Michigan, in Wisconsin, if you like.
Well, clearly, thank you for the opportunity to be here. But clearly what we have here is an agenda that was started, as Sheldon mentioned, in 1947, where some political folks get involved and stick their nose into the collective bargaining. It's kind of ironic that the party that always talks about getting regulations off the back of business is more than willing to put a regulation in place that says that businesses can't sit down and bargain with their employers about terms and conditions, including employee security clauses. I don't quite understand that. It's been a long and ongoing effort on the part of a handful of folks who represent the interests of the wealthy and the corporations to crush the labor union movement in this country. Shell probably has a better grasp of the history, but throughout the formation of unions prior to the Wagner Act even, which effectively legalized unions, folks in this country were trying to get dignity and respect in the workplace. That's something that's continued to this day. Danny mentioned the dignity and respect. That's principally one of the main reasons why people go after collective bargaining agreements by organizing to form a union. Mm-hmm. You talk about the circumstances where that gentleman on the tape said that
Don Harris, yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when they were treated so badly. I'd argue today folks at Walmart who are deprived from wages and benefits, have lousy schedules, aren't really in all actuality treated that much differently than the folks were back in the 30s. But fundamentally, we haven't seen any change in the behavior of corporations.
Ken Sager, we're coming up on a break, and I wanted to continue this conversation, of course, after the break. But to the point of this law, this right-to-work law, why shouldn't I, if I go work at a unionized plant, why shouldn't I have the freedom to say no to paying union dues?
Well, here's a couple of thoughts on that.
Quickly, and we can continue it after the break, please.
Absolutely. One is, if you don't want to be a part of a union, don't go to work someplace where there is a union. If your plant doesn't have a union and there's an election, it's a democracy. It's a majority rule. Even those folks who voted for Mitt Romney are going to have to live for the next 4 years with President Obama because majority rules.
Okay, and very quickly, why Iowa has had a right-to-work law since 1947? Has Iowa suffered because of that?
Clearly, our wages would be much higher had we not passed that in 1947. Some 40,000 Iowans got together and stood on the steps of the state capitol and asked then-Governor Blue not to sign it, and he came out and basically thumbed his nose at those workers and signed the right-to-work law into effect in Iowa.
We'll be right back with Ken Sager, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, Danny Holman, president of AFSCME, Council 61, the American Federation of State Council and Municipal Employees. Tammy Warro will hear from the ISEA president when we come back. What's your perception of unions? Are you a union member? Tell us your experience. Do you think the power of unions is declining? If so, why? 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, talking about the state of unions in Iowa. That is meaning by that organized labor in light of the fact that Michigan is now a so-called right-to-work state, signing into law a bill that prevents unions from requiring employees to pay dues, even in unionized workplaces. Also, in the context of what happened last year in Wisconsin, the rolling back collective bargaining rights. And we want to hear from you this hour, your perception of unions. Are you a union member? Tell us your experience, why you think they are still relevant, important in the 21st century? Do you think their power is declining? If so, why? 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. Joining us today, Professor Shelton Stromquist of the University of Iowa, who specializes in looking in the fields of U.S. labor and social history, author of Solidarity and Survival, an Oral History of Iowa Labor in the 20th Century. Also with us, Danny Homan, president of Iowa AFSCME Council 61, and Ken Sager, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, to give us their perspectives, as well as Tammy Warrow, the ISEA president, the Iowa State Education Association. And before the break, we were talking with Danny Homan and Ken Sager, Shelton, about, they were referencing your comments about the origins of organized labor in this country, to talk about what's going on today. I wondered, what is your perspective as a historian, if we have historical precedents for the pushing back, decline the of union power in the country, but more specifically in Michigan and Wisconsin?
Well, I think the thing that one has to say right off the bat is that union rights have never been secure. They've always been susceptible to erosion. There's a saying in the clothing workers union, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers Union, that every generation's got to do it again. And in a sense, that's unfortunately been true, that people have made tremendous sacrifices to build unions, to try to protect themselves and their rights at work, only to see those rights repeatedly eroded. So what we're seeing today is part of a larger and longer pattern. I mean, I think back, for instance, to World War I, and this was really before the Wagner Act and before the NRA and before Franklin Roosevelt. During the war, the Wilson administration instituted something called the National War Labor Board. And the National War Labor Board was set up to try to maintain labor peace in a war-heated economy. For a while, it worked pretty well. And unions were given a right to represent their members. Other companies organized shop committees. There were conversations about how to maintain production and how to, at the same time, create a more humane workplace. Come the end of the War Labor Board was dismantled. And the new Harding administration had absolutely no interest in maintaining any of those rights and guarantees. And so the 1920s represents one of the lowest points in the history of American labor in terms of the number of workers represented. So it took another generation in the 1930s, as we've been talking about earlier, to begin to rebuild that right and that ability to defend yourself in the workplace. And of course, then Taft-Hartley and then another phase of rebuilding in the 1960s, and then another wave of anti-union public policy, and so it goes. So I think what we're seeing today is another phase of that struggle. It simply means that workers are going to have to go back to their traditions and begin to build all over again.
Number of calls we want to get to in just a moment, but a couple of other things. Tammy Warrow, president of the Iowa State Education Association, as president of the union for Iowa's teachers, your perspective on this, what we've been seeing nationally in Wisconsin and Michigan.
Well, first of all, I do feel the need to take a moment to share that our thoughts and prayers are out to our brothers and sisters in Connecticut. We have suffered across the nation a tremendous tragedy, and those are our students, those are our members, and we at ISEA are heartbroken. I know my colleagues across the state have gone to work today and are doing everything they can because that's their job. They go to work every day to serve their students. And we're 34,000 members strong. We work hard every day. And what happens in Wisconsin and Michigan, absolutely, it affects us as far as our morale and how we feel the public feels about public workers, because let's face it, educators are public workers.
Mm-hmm. Let me quote this to you, because we see that an increasing number of Americans are skeptical of the efficacy of teachers' unions. Since 1976, Gallup has surveyed Americans' perception of teachers' unions' efficacy. In 1976, 38% of Americans believed teachers' unions hurt the quality of public education in the U.S. Now let's jump forward from 1976 to 2011. Nearly half of Americans think teacher unionization has hurt the quality of public education in the U.S. So that's a dramatic jump, primarily in those polls between 1998 and 2011, leaping from 26% to 47%. The skepticism growing. How do you explain that, Tammy Worrell?
Well, I certainly believe there is a PR effort out there to have the public have some sentiments of that. In Iowa, our Iowa State Education Association has done a marvelous job of putting the professionalism out in the forefront. You know, this is our AMA. This is our professional organization. And our voice and our profession is very important. We take that seriously. We are at the table talking about education reform. We have bargained quality evaluation systems. I think there is misconception out there about Iowa laws. We don't have a tenure law in Iowa, but you'll hear that thrown out. I even saw it on some Republican literature that went out. Stop the tenure law and the tenure law in Iowa. We don't have that. So there is some misconception out there, and I'm not sure how to get that out.
Okay. For the record, we did invite for this conversation about organized labor in Iowa, House Republicans, Senate Republicans, the governor's office, the Iowa Association of Business and Industry to be on this program on Iowa Public Radio about organized labor. They declined our invitation. I wanted to mention that again. Let's go to our guests in Des Moines, Danny Homan and Ken Sager. Please speak up about this perception, because we can see, I mentioned some Gallup poll results about the efficacy of teachers' unions, but when we talk about approval of labor unions, a slim majority of Americans, 52%, according to the latest Gallup poll. The wordage there I'm not quite sure of, but we do know that public support for unions is lower than it has been in the past. Why is that?
Well, I think Tammy talked real directly about the long-term public relations efforts by some on the far right. I mean, they've got their own news network, for crying out loud, who constantly have the drumbeat going about how bad, you know, the union thugs are. Well, I'd echo Tammy's sentiments. The union thugs protected a lot of children and saved a lot of lives here in this recent tragedy. Many of the things that those of us who work in the trade union movement try to do isn't simply for the workers that we have collective bargaining agreements for. For example, when we try to make sure there's education funding at an appropriate level, that's to make sure that everybody's kids get a good education. When we work to try to improve unemployment insurance, that's not just for union workers who lose their job, that's for all workers. Mm-hmm. When we work for workers' compensation improvements, that's for any worker who gets injured on the job, not just those who happen to have a union card in their pocket. We are fighting a multi-million-dollar machine that's been established by folks like the Koch brothers to denigrate the labor movement. As Sheldon pointed out, it's like a tide. Every now and then it comes in, and we see our rights eroded. Over the last, say, from 2008, about 10.6% of Iowans were protected by collective bargaining agreements. As of 2011, that number is up to 11.2%. Mm-hmm. As these employers become more and more hardline with their employees, they seek to protection. They seek to make sure that their dignity and respect in the workplace are protected by joining trade unions. And I think we're starting to see maybe an overreach by those folks on the far right in terms of trying to beat down working people in the middle class in this country, because it's pretty clear any numbers that you look at, as the union movement numbers decline on a national level, so does the percent of income that the middle class gets. And frankly, a lot of folks who've never been involved in a trade union movement have benefited greatly from the things that we've done, from promoting child labor laws to workplace safety. Okay. They'll miss us if the right is successful in beating labor unions to the ground.
Our hour is quickly slipping away from us. We want to get to callers who have been listening to this conversation. Let's first go to Tom in Mason City. Hi, Tom.
Hi. How are you doing?
Doing fine. What is your experience or your opinion, your concern here?
Well, I'm a recent employee of Hostess Brands, and as you know, we no longer exist as a company with Wonder Bread and Hostess under one roof, and I don't know what the company's doing with the product line at this point. I know they're trying to hawk it to somebody, but what I saw as union participation shrank away in the location I was in Mason City and throughout Iowa where we have so-called right to work, is less and less really caring on the part of our employees. And I guess I really feel that had we had better union participation on the part of employees where, you know, it was kind of like not a right to work, but a closed shop situation, I believe that we could have saved that company. Because, you know, when you feel you have a stake in something and its existence is important, you want to keep it alive. And what I saw was a real lack of caring.
Tom, thank you for that perspective from Mason City. Sorry for the loss of your job, as, of course, as well. Let's go to Waterloo on the phone still. Radonna, I hope I'm getting your name right. Radonna?
Radonna Parker, yes.
Radonna, hi. Are you or were you a union member?
Yes, I've worked for a good company for years, a company that does have a union. I work for the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say, the company has been good to us, the union even better. We have always had a livable wage. We've had good benefits for our children. I was able to send my children to school, provide a good lifestyle for them. And and we have holiday pay, time off, but this wasn't given to us by the company. It was fought for by union rights. We got union contracts. We pay union dues so that we do have some say in what our worker rights are going to be. People forget what it was like without unions before. There were no child labor laws. There were long hours, no overtime pay. Back in the day, they put five-year-olds in the coal mines. People forget. And now, because of corporate policy, or should I say greed, it's understandable that the less you pay your employees, the more profits are. But before, companies used to have respect for their employees. Employees provided long hours of labor, and the company gave us good pay.
Radonna, let me ask you this. We have other callers. I wanted to ask you, where do you think union power stands today in relation to past decades?
Well, because of negative public...
Oh, I'm sorry, Radonna. I pressed the wrong thing. Let me try to get you back. Radonna, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we can hear you again now. Thank goodness.
Because of negative public relations by anti-union groups, a lot of people, younger people especially, don't know what it was like without unions, and they put the wrong information out there as if you belong to a union, you can't do this or you have to. It's because basically it's Republican ethics. You pay and you get. But right now, people that don't belong to unions are able to work for the companies and still get the rights that union workers have fought and paid for. I don't think that's fair.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to me.
Radonna, thank you. From Waterloo, let's quickly go to Andrea before we wrap up with our guests in studio. Andrea is in Muscatine. Hi.
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. We have limited time. What's on your mind in this regard?
Okay. I just wanted to say I'm a union supporter. My grandfather worked in the coal mines in southern Iowa. And when he got a job at the Morrell packing plant in Ottumwa in 1948, they moved up to Ottumwa. And so unions have always been good in for my family. And I think I wanted to address your question, why aren't unions as popular in the past? And I think some of the people have contributed, you know, to a very negative campaign. I do know that my grandfather only had a sixth grade education, and I think manufacturing jobs lend themselves to unionism because they are able to help people like my grandfather get their rights and obtain protections. I'm currently in a teacher's union, and I was also, before I was a teacher, in the Teamsters union, and I've always seen them as vital in protecting rights for workers. I know my mother, who is a teacher, had no union. There was no teacher's union in Iowa at that time period, and she worked for $2,000 a year, and when she went to apply for a job in a small Iowa town, she was interviewed by a board of men who said, she was only 19 at the time, by the way, you only need a two-year license, and they asked her what kind of birth control she was going to use since she was a married woman, you know, humiliating her. She just turned around and left because they could do things like that back then. I just think unions are vital and important in protecting our protections and giving us a living wage, and I don't know why they want us to go back. I mean, they say we are overpaid, but why do we want to pay people not a living wage in America?
Andrea,
I don't understand.
Thank you very much. Plenty of callers, not plenty of time, unfortunately. Mike writing us to point out something that I wanted to point out, too. We talked about the child labor laws. We had a caller mention that 40-hour work week. Now, aren't these, Ken Sager, federally protected now? Could you point to more recent, current reasons for the existence of unions?
Well, I would mention that it wasn't all that long ago. Just, I think, last legislative session, one of the state legislators wanted to cut back on child labor laws. Just because we have them in law at this point in time doesn't mean they're carved in stone. We have to be ever vigilant to make sure that those rights are maintained. And frankly, if you look at some of the other things, I think Danny's got a good example.
Hey, I believe there was a presidential candidate that came up with the idea of having underprivileged, is what I would call them, school children work as custodians in the schools where they went to work and where they went to school. Mm-hmm. So if that's not trying to bring back child labor, I don't know what is, because they were talking about elementary schools.
Quickly, go ahead, sorry.
So, I mean, I'll reiterate what Ken was saying. Just because it's in law doesn't mean you can't have a group of people come in later and repeal those laws.
Okay, let's talk a little bit before we have to go about membership in unions. In 2011, the union membership rate of wage and salary workers who were members of a union, 11.8%. That's 2011. Go back to 1983, the first year for which comparable union data are available from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, where I take this from. That was at over 20%. So over 20% down to almost 12%. Why is membership in unions declining, Danny Homan?
Well, I believe it's because a lot of employers are taking their jobs overseas or shutting down their businesses or doing like the hostess did with the Twinkie, selling off the company and taking the profits and running. The private sector unions have been under attack by shipping jobs overseas, and the public sector unions, their union density is much higher. I think the union density for public sector unions in this country is over 30%. I can tell you that AASME, Iowa Council 61, is growing. Our membership are at all-time highs because of some of the dignity and respect issues that state employees feel do not exist from the current administration. So, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's technology, doing more with less, sending our jobs to China and Mexico, just flat elimination of jobs.
Tammy Warrow, wanted to get you in here before we have to say goodbye. Quickly, a comment you wanted to make?
Well, I did want to say that one of the largest growing parts of the ISEA is our student program. And we have really grown in our student membership and our education programs across the state. And I see that they understand this is a really important part of their profession. Iowa State just put on 200 new ISEA members in their pre-education program. So they understand they have to be part of this conversation.
And in closing, Ken Sager, can I get a comment about you? What do you see coming for Iowa in the coming legislative session? What are your concerns? What do you think may happen here?
Well, frankly, I'm not real optimistic about a lot of positive progressive actions being taken by our legislature. Last legislative session, we spent a lot of time fighting off Wisconsin's style attacks on our public workers, and it's unfortunate, but I suspect we'll probably see some efforts in that regard. We have to make sure that we have appropriate funding to provide the public services necessary to have a civilized society. Those are the folks who make sure that our kids are taught, make sure that our streets are plowed, make sure that government works for us. And we've got to make sure that the governor doesn't continue his giving money back to wealthy corporations and tax breaks for corporate entities. We've got to make sure that we spend our money on the infrastructure necessary for our society to function properly.
Ken Sager, president of the Iowa Federation of Labor, Danny Holman, president of Iowa AFSCME Council 61, and Tammy Worrell, ISEA president. Thank you for joining us, along with Shelton Stromquist, University of Iowa professor of history. We've run out of time, far too much to talk about, but thank you all for your perspectives today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Caitlin Fry in Des Moines, help from John Pemble. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.